and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tinellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. This episode is brought to you by HarperCollins Australia. Art, history, lies and family secrets are at the heart of another stunning debut Aussie novel I recently had the utter pleasure of reading. Lisa Medved's mesmerising novel, The Engraver's Secret, is the story of two women linked over the span of 400 years through a mysterious map and a family secret. Lisa is an Australian author who divides her time between Melbourne and The Hague. Earning a Bachelor of Arts in History and Fine Art from the University of Melbourne, Lisa subsequently worked in public relations and event management, writing for various corporate publications and several magazines in the UK and the Netherlands. And with such a background, it is easy to see why the world of art history has drawn Lisa into its fascinating web. Set between Antwerp in the Spanish Netherlands in the 1620s and the Antwerp of Belgium in the present day, The Engraver's Secret centres on the stories of Antonia Forsterman and Charlotte Hubert, who share some common traits, a passion for art, their intelligence, and fiercely independent natures. A rich, fascinating, and vividly drawn story that I was genuinely sorry to finish. To that end, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to chat with Lisa on the podcast today. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. It's lovely to see you. It's lovely to hear you.
And lovely to hear and see you and meet you for the very first time, Lisa. And I wanted to say congratulations on this incredible novel.
Thank you very much. It's been 10 years in the making because I basically had to teach myself how to be a fiction writer. I started off with corporate writing, and corporate writing did a bit of magazine writing, and those two styles of writing are completely different to fiction writing. But I've always had a passion for history and art, and so I delved back into that.
Yeah, and I can see all of that playing out in this wonderful novel. And as I mentioned to you before we started recording, Lisa, I'm still reeling from the knowledge that this is your first novel. I mean, not only do you tackle two vastly different timelines, but your story centres on real-life characters and events, some of which are not well-known historically speaking. So what I wanted to ask you was, where do you start writing a novel like this?
I started having the idea about The Engraver's Secret when I caught a train down to Antwerp, because I live in The Hague, so it's a short train journey away. I went down with a friend. We visited the Plantain Mauritius Printing Museum with all their old 16th century printing presses and engravings on the walls. And then we visited the Rubens House. And they had this fascinating exhibition about his engraver, Lucas Forsterman. And the exhibition talked about how the two men had worked very, very closely together, with Forsterman doing engravings of Rubens's largest artworks. And then they had a spectacular falling out. And so I came back home, I was all intrigued, and I did a little bit of research, and not much known is about their falling out, but it was basically about the copyright, or who owned the right for the engraving plates that Forsterman had created, and who had the right to print from them and sell those prints.
Absolutely fascinating premise. Can you tell us a little bit more about these engraving plates? Because I had a little bit of trouble trying to understand what they were. I understood that they were, you know, for the purposes of creating likenesses of the original artworks, but I didn't really understand how they worked.
Yeah. So 17th century engravers would use a very fine tool called a burin, which is a metal cutting tool, and they'd use it to scratch an image into a smooth copper plate. And after the image is scratched into the copper plate is then covered in ink, usually black, but sometimes coloured ink. And then paper is placed on top, then it's passed through a press. And after the paper is peeled off, it reveals a printed mirror image of the copper plate. So Lucas Forsterman, in my story, is the engraver, and he was employed by Rubens in real life to make copies of Rubens's most popular artworks. And a lot of Rubens's artworks were massive in scale, 2 by 3 meters. Mm. And Rubens was also an accomplished diplomat, and he would visit all the royal courts of Europe. And so after diplomatic business had finished for the day, he would talk about his art and what he was doing. And back in those days, there was no iPad that he could pull out, or, you know, iPhone to pull out and say, here's a copy of something called the Lion Hunt that I've just done. You know, King Philip, would you like one for your palace? He had to resort to using engravers who would make a much smaller version of his artwork. And the engraver also had to work in mirror image. And so Rubens used the engravings as a marketing tool to promote his work and promote his studio.
His calling card.
It was very much a calling card.
Absolutely fascinating. Now, Lisa, did you always fancy yourself as a novelist, or was this more of a recent goal? I know you said that this was kind of 10 years in the making, but had you always thought you had a novel inside you?
No, I didn't. I think I dabbled with writing, creative writing, when I was a youngster at school. I ended up studying history and art history at the University of Melbourne because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Quite a few people just said to me, well, just study what you love. And I've always loved history. I've always loved art. And I was lucky enough to live overseas as a child. Then I lived overseas as an adult. And then when you're surrounded by so many different cultures and experiences and cities and towns and villages and different people and art museums from all over the world, you can't help but be influenced by what's around you. I'd worked in, you know, corporate world, media relations, public relations, event management. And then I had a break from working to have my family. And then when the kids had grown up a little bit and started to leave home, and I thought, oh, I've got some spare time on my hands. And then I started dabbling with fiction writing. I fell into it, literally.
So from go to woe, how long would you say The Engraver's Secret took you to write?
10 years. So The first 6 to 7 years were writing one version after the other, because the first version was really, really bad. So I'm glad you didn't read that. And it was just a matter of attending lots of courses, doing lots of online work. I also attended several face-to-face residential courses in England, because by that stage I was living in the Netherlands. And I just kept on honing my writing skills. And then when I thought the manuscript was polished enough, I found a literary agent based in London. And then soon after, I did a bit more editing work on it. And then the book was picked up by a Belgian publisher, even though it had never been published in English. And it was written in English. He wanted to translate it into Dutch. And so it first came out in Dutch.
Fascinating.
So it was published with a completely different cover and completely in a language that I didn't really understand, all through Belgium and the Netherlands. And so that was in February 2022. And it was really lovely, actually, very special, writing a book about Antwerp, set in Antwerp, about people from Antwerp. And to have it launched in that city of Antwerp was really special. But it's so delightful to be actually able to launch it in my home country now.
I love that story, Lisa. Thanks so much for sharing. So for those who haven't yet had the pleasure of reading it as I have, I wondered if you could tell listeners more about the story.
The Engraver's Secret is an art thriller set in Antwerp with a dual timeline. And it's about two women, a mysterious map and a secret that's been kept for 400 years. The 17th century timeline features the engraver's daughter called Antonia, who is on the front cover of the book, and her father, the engraver, who works in the studio of the famous artist Peter Paul Rubens. And Antonia is drawn into the life of the studio and the Rubens family, and she begins to realize that secrets are being kept and people are betraying one another. And she starts to realize that she can't even trust her own father, who she loves and adores. The modern day timeline is revealed through the eyes of an art academic called Charlotte, who arrives in Antwerp, and she very quickly becomes embroiled in this 400-year-old mystery about Rubens and his engraver. And at the same time, she meets her father for the first time. And like Antonia, Charlotte discovers that everyone at the university is keeping secrets and people are betraying one another and no one can be trusted. So it's a story that very much juxtaposes two father-daughter relationships in two completely different centuries.
Absolutely stunning. I loved every bit of it. In particular, I was fascinated by the crafting of this story. And as you mentioned, the story is written across two different timelines, 1620s and modern day. However, as you've already alluded to, you managed to imbue in both stories some similar themes. You know, one, the father-daughter relationship that you already spoke about, family secrets and betrayal, but also theft of intellectual property. So I wanted to ask you, were these themes you were intent on exploring in advance of writing the novel, or did these kind of emerge as you were writing?
Great question. Some of these themes I knew right from the start that I wanted to write. For example, I wanted the theme to be very much about strong, independent women who don't need to be rescued. They can rescue themselves. They learn how to ask for help, but they're strong and independent women. So that was a theme I knew right from the start. But the other theme about intellectual theft was something that just sort of gradually emerged as I was writing the story. Obviously, I had the 17th century side of the story, which was very much about intellectual property and who had ownership of particular items. In this case, it was the copper engraving plates and also the printed engravings from those plates. But then it started to emerge that in the academic world, there is also an issue of intellectual theft that goes on even today, where people are stealing people's ideas. And I thought it was a lovely way to juxtapose what was happening in the 1600s with the modern day. And so that modern part of intellectual theft was added into the story in one of the earlier versions when I was writing it.
I just loved this part of the story. I felt that it offered such insight into academia and the cutthroat nature of that world that so very few people truly understand.
Yes, indeed. I was only at university for 3 or 4 years, so I personally didn't experience any of that sort of side of academia myself. But having read and done a lot of research, I know that it does happen across the world today.
As you alluded to, Antonia is a young woman who's not only incredibly accomplished and who knows her own mind, but someone for whom family is everything. Mm-hmm. Her relationship with her father and his encouragement of her intellect is one that sets the tone for her entire life, really. Her father was keen for her not only to learn the usual skills a young woman of her social standing was expected to have, but those less common, for example, languages, mathematics, geography, and history. That wasn't unusual, but certainly not common for that time, was it?
No, definitely not. And I think because Lucas Vorsterman in real life was a very learned intellectual man, he spoke multiple languages. And so I wanted to be able to pass on that attitude that he wanted for his whole family. But of course, you know, he ended up treating his daughter, Antonia, different to his sons.
I can understand why in the context of that time. But anyway, she ends up becoming a cartologist, and that was something that was unrecognized during her lifetime. Can you talk more about this and why you wanted to explore this in the context of this novel?
I experimented with a few different art forms. I was wondering maybe at one stage I might make Antonia an engraver like her father, or I might make her an artist, you know, having been influenced by the apprentices in the Rubens house. But then I became quite intrigued by the whole background of map making and cartography. And I'd actually, with my husband and I, had visited a little shop in Belgium, a little antique shop, and we found this beautiful old antique map folio that was filled with about 20 different maps. I think it was from the 1800s. We didn't end up buying it. We couldn't afford it. But I just remember it so vividly that it was hand-colored. And I thought, what an amazing way, you know, as part of my story, that maybe I could put cryptic clues inside of this map folio. And so that's when I started thinking about, well, maybe Antonia can do something different to her father. Maybe she doesn't have to go down the route of engraver or painter. She can do something also creative, but more as a cartographer.
Yeah, I loved that. And I loved the detail with which you explored her obvious fascination with this and the creation of these beautiful maps and the folio of maps that Charlotte ends up looking at in the present timeline. I'm so interested to hear that you found something along those lines.
Yes,
too.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I just delved right into the whole research of Abraham Ortelius, Frederick de Witt, who are real people. And I found an old Frederick de Witt map, which is featured in my book. And I use that as inspiration because it's so incredibly detailed. So I learned quite a lot about cartography in the 1600s, and it's fascinating.
I loved learning about it through your book as well. Comparatively, in the present timeline, Charlotte has grown up without knowing her father. And yet this too sets the tone for her life in a vastly different way, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. Thought it would be an interesting contrast to have Antonia having this very close relationship. She's very loyal and devoted towards her father, and to contrast that completely with Charlotte, who's always thought her father had died, and suddenly meets him for the first time when she's 34 years old. And what a tremendous shock that was to her, and how emotionally she was torn between her mother, who had lied to her for so many years, and meeting her father for the first time and trying to make sense of this complete mayhem that was happening in her personal life.
Yeah, indeed. Now, the other thing that I thought was quite interesting across both timelines is that you explore, or you deal with deathbed confessions, essentially. You know, Antonia's father makes a deathbed confession and gives her knowledge about something he needs to get off his chest, but burdens her in the process with something quite grave, I think. And at the same time, Charlotte's mother does the very same thing.
Yes.
And burdens her with something that I don't think she's emotionally equipped to deal with at that point in her life. I thought that was rather unfair for both of them to do that to their children.
I suppose we don't know what we will do when we're faced with that situation, when we're on our deathbed, or when we're with a loved one and holding their hand when they're experiencing their last moments. So it was absolutely unfair what they did, but I think it was also realistic. I think, you know, when people are faced with the end, they look back on their life and they think of the regrets and the mistakes that they've made, and they want to somehow make it right. They want to offload what's been causing them so much heartache.
I guess in both the cases, I kind of felt like both Antonia and Charlotte had questions about what was divulged to them on their parents' deathbed that they could do nothing about. You know, they had a lot of issues that were thrown up as a result of those confessions.
Yeah, and I think that made them really emotional and very, you know, emotionally tortured as to wanting to know the answers and knowing that there was no opportunity to have those answers given to them. And they just had to make the best of the situation. They had to make the most of what information that they had. And they had a decision as to how they were going to respond to that. And they both respond in different ways. And I think the whole dynamics of families and how close you can be with your family and how distant you can be from your family is something that we all experience in different levels in our lifetime. And I thought it was something that readers could relate to. There's a lot of love that goes on with families, but there is also, you know, there can also be betrayal and secrets and hurt, and people react to those situations in different ways.
Lisa, we already talked about the fact that Lucas Forsterman and Peter Paul Rubens and even Antonia herself are actual historical figures, and the feud between the two men was an actual feud. And I wondered, how, as a novelist, do you write about real life characters and factual events but also inject fiction? How do you find that space between exploring the real and writing the imagined?
I was very aware of writing about real people, because Lucas Forsterman is a real person, Peter Paul Rubens is a real person, and making sure that I didn't say anything really horrible about them. And so that's why I was able to take a little bit of that fact that I learned about their disagreement, but not a lot is written about that. So I felt confident that I could spin a story and remind my readers that this is fiction. We don't really know if this is how the two men reacted to one another in this situation. It is a work of fiction. But the important thing to know about Rubens is he was a very, very famous person, even during his lifetime, very, very successful. And so much has been written about him. And he was very much a loyal and devoted family man. He put his family above everything. Not a lot is known about Lucas Forsterman. The only thing that is known in historical records about his daughter, Antonia, is that he had a daughter, that she was called Antonia. He might have had other daughters. He definitely had other sons. And then there's just a little snippet about, in a historian in the 19th century wrote about how his daughter cared for him in the final years of his life. Mm-hmm. And to me, that said so much about their relationship. So I felt very confident that even though I was writing a fictionalized account of factual people, that I was still being kind to them.
And did you find it easy to come up with some kind of, essentially, you were finding like a backstory to this feud and what made them behave this way and the things that happened afterwards? Did you find it easy to come up with that plot point?
Like my character in the modern day, Charlotte uses a mind map. where she has a central issue or problem in the center of the mind map, and then she has all these jumping off points and lots of ideas. And I think that's how I approach my writing. I get to a part of the story and I realize it can go in 20 different directions. And sometimes, and that's probably why it took me so long to write the story, because I would experiment with, you know, well, let's see what happens when it goes in this direction. And it just didn't feel comfortable. And so for me, it was very much experimentation until I settled on a story that I was really happy with.
Lisa, as I mentioned in my introduction, this was such a vividly drawn novel in both timelines, but I think particularly the historical one. So I wanted to ask you, how did you put yourself in the mindset to write about this period? Because I imagined it would have taken so much research.
I started off by writing Charlotte's story in the modern day because I'm more familiar with the modern day than I am with living in the 16th century. So I sort of immersed myself in academia, the modern day Antwerp, and tried to really create the character of Charlotte in my mind. And then I put her aside completely, had a break for a couple of months. And then I started writing about Antonia, and I just started drawing on a huge amount of research and also visiting places. I lost count the number of times I've been to Antwerp. Sometimes it would just be for a weekend. Sometimes I go with my husband, sometimes with a friend, sometimes by myself. And just to walk around the cobblestone streets, just to visit the museums, the art galleries, stand there and just look at the paintings. It was a very immersive experience for me to get into the frame of mind of what was Antonia thinking? Mm. What did she want out of life? Was she 100% loyal and devoted to her father? Or was she wanting to break free from him and do something completely different? So there were lots of questions I was constantly asking as I was writing the story. And there were several moments that I'd be writing a chapter and I had clear idea as to where I thought this chapter was heading. And then I would just come to a halt, and it was almost as though the character was standing there saying, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't do that. And then I'd find that I'd gotten to know the character so well that they were really speaking to me, and I was able to finish the chapter in a more appropriate way that was true to the nature of the character. So as a first-time novelist, I found that quite startling to almost feel as though these characters are speaking to you.
Okay, so another major part of this story was set in Antwerp's Begijnhof, which to my mind operated a bit like a convent, but its residents, the Begijn or the Begijnen, were free to leave at any time. So can you tell me why you wanted to set part of the story there? Why was it important to your story?
I wasn't thinking of including the Begijnhof in the story until on one of my trips down to Antwerp, and I was wandering around and my husband and I actually just fell upon it one day. And it's open to the public. It doesn't operate as a Begijnhof anymore. All the rooms and buildings have been turned into private housing, but the cobblestone drive in the center is still there. The garden with the fruit trees is still there. All the step gable buildings and the red brick walls and the chapel with the statues of the Mother Mary are still there. And I thought, what a fabulous place. And that's when I started coming up with this part of the story I wanted it set in the Begijnhof, because it was such an immersive place to be. And it's so typical of Belgium to have that sort of architecture. So apparently the last Begijn in Belgium died in about the 1990s. And so I've just stretched the timeline by a couple more decades, allow them to be in my Begijnhof, in my creation of the Engraver's Secret. I think if the last one had died off in the 1500s, it would have been a real push to do that. But I thought, I can stretch it for a couple more decades. And it's such a beautiful place. If you ever get to go there, it's very atmospheric.
Well, in fact, I did look it up. I was very interested to understand what it looked like now and to try and imagine the Begijns living there and working there. A fascinating place to hide lots of secrets, I imagine.
Yes. And the other reason I thought it would be lovely to have some sort of modern day interpretation from the religious side of things is that in the 17th century part of the story, religion was such an important part of people's lives. You can't ignore it. It would be very difficult to write a 17th century novel and not mention people going to church or the conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics. And so I thought it would be intriguing to introduce a modern day element of that. Mm. So that's the other reason why I thought the Begijnhof in the modern day would be interesting to add in to the story.
Yeah, I found that part of the story really fascinating as well, particularly in your book. The Vorstemans end up fleeing Antwerp and living in London for a couple of years as a result of what I believe was the conflict between Vorsterman yes. and Rubens. And they end up leaving London again as a result of essentially anti-Catholic sentiment there.
Yes. I learned all about that while I was researching. I really love that part of it. And that goes back to being a history student from university, learning about not just the big famous people and what they were doing and the kings and the queens, but, you know, the everyday people, how they coped with this constant threat in their lives, this constant conflict when it came to their religion and also the politics and what was being decided by the government.
Indeed. Now, Lisa, you mentioned that the Dutch version of your book came out in February of 2022. So what's the reception been like over there, particularly given all the, you know, local sites and attractions that you've mentioned in the book?
Yeah, it's been extremely popular in Antwerp and in other places of Belgium. Also popular in the Netherlands, but I think when you have a book that is set in, you know, a particular country or in this case, a particular city, Antwerp almost becomes like another character in the story. It's one of those stories that if people are planning to travel to Antwerp, it can be a lovely way to get just a little snippet of what the city was like 400 years ago and what it's like now. I had quite a few people interested in it from the fact that it's set in Antwerp and recreates what Antwerp was like back then.
Yeah, and also gives them great places to consider visiting.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Who knows, maybe there's going to be an engraver secret tour of Antwerp that people can go on one day.
Why not, indeed?
Yeah, maybe that's something I need to do, and I can do a whole map, you know, download the map and walk in the footsteps of Antonia and Charlotte.
I'm very glad that I helped you come up with that idea.
Thank you.
But yes, I would totally go on a tour like that.
Great. Okay.
Now, Lisa, you might know that there are lots of writers who listen to this podcast. And to that end, I wondered if there were any tips that you would like to offer writers out there looking to get their first novel published.
My biggest advice is to read broadly, not just the genre that you're interested in writing in, but in other genres. And also just to keep writing, even if you think what you're writing is no good, just keep on practicing, keep on writing, and experiment with whether it's first person or third person, or, you know, are you going to use dialogue? Are you going to include letters and other excerpts and other material inside your fiction writing? Just have fun experimenting with all of these things and keep copies of absolutely everything, because even though you might delete something, it could be that a year later you go, oh, I think I really do want to use that chapter that I deleted. And it's always nice to go back to it and rework it, and you've got the foundation of it.
Yeah. Fantastic. I love those tips. Thank you so much for sharing. So what's next? Are you working on something else at the moment?
Yes, I have moved my brain from 17th century Antwerp, and I've now moved it across to the late 19th century in Vienna. And so I'm now looking at, rather than the artwork of Rubens and Vorstemann, I'm now looking at Gustav Klimt. And so the next story that I'm crafting at the moment is going to look at mother-daughter relationships instead of father-daughter relationships. And it's going to bring in a lot of information about Gustav Klimt and the other people that were living in Vienna at the time. And then it's going to contrast with a young woman living in London in 1932. And so these two women are basically searching for where they belong in the world.
Sounds wonderful, and I can't wait to learn more about that in the fullness of time.
The other intriguing thing too that I learned a lot about the whole publishing process is how they put together the cover. The interesting thing about the cover that the HarperCollins design team have designed is that it's of an actual real person. She's not a creation of somebody's mind. She's a real person, and she was put on the cover because she's a model for a fine art photographer called Dmitry Bayev, who works in Odessa, Ukraine. He has a fabulous fine art photography studio, and he has all these intriguing and compelling looking models come in, and he dresses them up in the most fabulous costumes and he photographs them. And so that's where Antonia on the front cover comes from. So I like to think that underneath that gorgeous, romantic, flouncy, Baroque dress, she's probably wearing jeans and trainers.
Indeed, she probably is.
Yeah, she's a modern day girl. And I love the fact that the photographer, Dimitri Bayev, didn't give her an ornate hairdo. He gave her almost a modern hairdo. I like to think her hairstyle is almost like the modern day protagonist, Charlotte. And then everything else is this lush, Baroque, flamboyant style. And she actually looks like a real painting. And so like a real painting, her eyes almost follow you around the room. She's keeping an eye on you, and she's bold and she's courageous, and she knows how to look after herself.
Lisa, if listeners wanted to learn more about you and your book and your work, where can they find you?
I have a website, lisamedved.com, and I have a monthly musing newsletter where I usually just chatter about anything and everything to do with reading and writing. So sometimes I focus on writing, and I might give some writing advice or something that I found has really been helpful for me. I also jot down little musings about books that I've read recently, what I've really enjoyed, or places that I've visited that I found really inspirational. So people could just pop over to the website, have a look. They can sign up for my free newsletter. They can unsubscribe at any time. And I try to do it monthly.
Lisa, as you can no doubt tell, I absolutely adored this book. As surprising as it was compelling, I have no doubt it will find scores of readers around the world. Congratulations once again, and thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!